They've watched Citizen Kane a combined 200 times. Elliot's first words were, "I personally thought the use of Dutch angles was derivative in the 400 blows." In Nathan's favorite historical figure is Fritz Lang. Now they're bringing that snootiness to you with Magellan's at the Movies.
Hello, and welcome back to Magellan's at the Movies, brought to you by 8-time award desirers, Nathan and Elliot Mogulyines. Nathan, we have a lot to do today. This is going to be a bumper episode, so yeah. I'm going to dive right in. I've got four movies I want to talk about. Well, actually, first, let me just briefly touch on Alien Earth episode 4, I think, or 5, actually. Enjoyed it. I'm still on board. It was the bottle episode, so I don't love bottle episodes, but yeah. Still, it wasn't the worst thing in the world, and it brought us the Alien franchise's first ever sex scene, so that's your thing.
That's huge.
I know.
Well,
there's going to be like a million think pieces about Prometheus?
One of the Prometheus movies has a couple doing stuff in the shower.
Oh, shoot, you're right. Alien Covenant. Well, this is a little bit more explicit than that.
Oh, jeepers.
Well, anyway, it doesn't matter. Four movies I want to talk about. Two are in theaters, two are upcoming.
Okay.
First, in theaters, I have seen the Toxic Avenger remake. It was perfectly acceptable.
Great.
And that's a huge step up from the original, in my opinion.
All right.
I have to say I was a little baffled by the praise that it's getting, because it's gotten a very strong reception. And I guess people, it's definitely made for the faithful, right? The franchise faithful. So if you find yourself among that number, you'll probably really like it. Also, I have seen Caught Stealing, Aronofsky's new movie.
Oh, boy.
And I enjoyed it.
Oh,
definitely one of the better Aronofsky movies. Fair warning, the trailers have been, I think, not deceptive, because I don't think they're trying to pull the wool over your eyes or anything, but they are not representative of the movie's actual tone. Like, the trailers painted the picture, I felt, of a zany, fun, like, romp. And there is some zaniness and some fun, but on the whole, it's actually fairly, I don't know, somber, and some pretty sad stuff happens, so...
I've seen similar reviews saying that there's a different type of movie than what's being sold.
Well, yeah, there you go. But I still enjoyed it, and I think that it's worth seeing, honestly. Now, in terms of movies that are upcoming, I wanted to shout out The Long Walk. I'm guessing that the only reason this got made is because I said that I would like for it to get made in our episode about movies we want to see.
Yeah.
We want to see get made. So, and apparently I was right on the money with this, because it's been getting very strong early reviews. I'm very excited. I am extremely excited for Kathryn Bigelow's next movie, A House of Dynamite, which has been getting the reviews aren't even as strong as The Long Walk, or even the strongest coming out of the festival circuit.
Mm-hmm.
But man, this movie sounds great. If you didn't know, it's kind of like your Rashomon-style movie, in that it's the same event played from different perspectives. The event in question being the response to the launch of a nuclear missile from an unknown actor.
Hmm.
And so there's like 18 minutes between when the missile is detected and when it detonates. And so you have, I think, like three or four, some number of different people whose job it is to respond to that going through these 18 minutes.
Yeah.
I can't wait.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, this is actually one of the movies I was going to talk about that it looks exciting. Catherine Bigelow finally back after like a 9 year, 8 or 9 year hiatus or something since her last movie. It looks great. Like Elliot, like you said, Elliot, the film festivals are on. There's a couple of other movies I want to discuss as being very excited now that they've had premieres and we have reviews for some of these. One of those, obviously, A House of Dynamite. The other ones, Park Chan-wook's new movie, No Other Choice, receiving fantastic reviews out of its premiere. Everyone saying this is finally his time. He's going to get nominated for an Oscar. The man's been snubbed so many times. This is finally his time. I would love for that to be true. I loved his last movie. We did a review of it, Decision to Leave. Very excited for this. Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein got a premiere. Reviews are a little less than stellar for this one, which has kind of tempered my excitement for it a little bit. But I still think it's going to be neat. I'm still kind of excited for it. And then probably the biggest thing in terms of at least the reviews and the discussion that I've seen is Chloe Zhao's Hamnet, an adaptation of a book by the same name by Maggie O'Farrell, getting absolute raves out of its premieres, looking to be probably one of the Oscar frontrunners now as we move into the film, the fall festival season, and the Oscar conversation starts to heat up. It sounds like Jessie Buckley is going to be in the lead for Best Actress and these sorts of things. I'm super excited for this. I read the book just this past year. I thought the book was great. I think the trailer looks great. Chloe Zhao, to me, seems like a perfect pairing of director and material. I'm really excited for this movie to just be depressed for 2 hours because it's a tough, tough book. I can't imagine the movie is any... From reviews, it sounds like the movie is not any happier than the book. And, yeah, I think those are the big movies that are coming. Yorgos Lanthimos' new movie got a premiere. I'll see it, but I'm not quite as excited as I am for some of this other stuff. Elliot, are you interested in any of these other movies? Have you seen their discussion and their reactions?
Yeah, I've seen it. I mean, I enjoyed Nomadland. I haven't seen The Eternals or the movie about the cow. Was that Chloe Zhao's
first movie? No, that's Kelly Reinhart, something like that, First Cow. Although her new movie is also getting decent reviews, The Mastermind with that one guy.
Yeah, okay, whatever. So I don't know. I'm curious, I guess. I'm definitely excited for Frankenstein. Del Toro's never a director who I've really gelled with. I hardly think that he's a bad director, but I have never seen in him what a lot of other people see.
Yeah.
But this is source material that I'm very fond of, and I think that Del Toro actually is a pretty good choice for it. So I'm not that bothered about... I mean, I'm never really bothered about negative receptions or positive receptions, right? You know, yeah. you'll have your opinion and other people will have theirs.
Yeah, sure. And then No Other Choice you're really excited for, right?
What's No Other Choice?
Park Chan-wook's movie.
Oh, no, I'm not excited about that at all.
Dang it. All right, well... Anyway, we got to get into this episode because you know we're doing the 60s. We've been doing our best of the decade, talking about our favorite movies from a particular decade, and then arguing it out, battling it out over who has the best picks and how to put together our Magellan's at the Movies top 10 movies of this decade. We're on to the 60s. As always, everyone's favorite part. I keep getting emails about how much they love this part of the episode. We're going to talk about the historical context of the 60s and then the filmic context of the 60s. We're going to flip it over to Elliot. Boy, am I excited to hear about what you have to say about the 60s. I hope my personal favorite historical figure gets a mention in this little discussion we have here, but we'll see.
Talking about Fritz Lang?
No, no, not the one that I say in the intro of this episode. My actual favorite historical figure.
I don't know who that is. Oh, no, I know who that is. Yeah, he'll be in there.
Yes,
but he,
yes.
Well, we'll talk about it. He's only in there briefly.
Dang it.
Let's get started here. We will begin with the Cold War, which is widely agreed to have reached its height during the 60s. America sponsors the 1961 Bay of Pigs invasion in Cuba, a catastrophic failure that sets the stage for the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. After the failed invasion, a humiliated America is more determined than ever to get rid of Castro, Cuba's leader. To achieve this, the CIA's genius idea is sponsoring terrorist attacks on civilian targets in Cuba under Operation Mongoose. Now, Nathan, I know because you're a traitorous pinko that you're going to hear that and you're going to think to yourself, I don't think that makes much sense. But that just reveals how far beneath the big brains of Central Intelligence you really are. Because reasoning, obviously, behind Mongoose is that Cuba would have to respond by both dedicating resources to defense rather than public services and by implementing intrusive social surveillance measures. Measures that would be so unpopular the Cuban people would, I don't know, rebel or something. This inventive long shot fails, and the CIA spends a year or so farting around with violent insurgencies and increasingly cartoonish plots to assassinate Castro.
Wow. I don't remember usually there being this much color commentary about the historical context.
Look, every comment you make makes this take longer. As a result, the Cuban dictator is enthusiastically receptive to Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev, there he is, Nathan, proposal to field Soviet missiles on the island nation. Khrushchev's scheme being to simultaneously retaliate for NATO missiles in Turkey and bag himself an unbeatable first strike position. What follows is 13 days of global horror as Khrushchev and U.S. President Kennedy trade threats. Kennedy implements a quarantine, that's really a blockade, around the island, and Soviet submarine commander Vasily Arkhipov quite possibly saves the world when he refuses to authorize the launching of the flotilla's missiles after American practice charges are mistaken for the initiation of hostilities. Thanks, Vasily. Eventually, catastrophe is averted thanks to secret negotiations that heavily favor Kennedy, resulting in a perceived victory for the U.S., a black eye for Khrushchev, and a very disappointed Castro. Castro's personal hang-ups are compounded some years later by the assassination of his right-hand man, Che Guevara. After a stint running legally questionable revolutionary tribunals, managing the Cuban economy pretty much by himself, and posing for the photo, you know the photo, Guevara just kind of naffs off and becomes a global standard bearer for the revolution, meeting with dignitaries, giving talks, and dodging assassination attempts around the world. However, his luck runs out when he travels to Bolivia to aid guerrillas fighting the country's military junta. After struggling to reinvigorate the insurgent forces, Guevara is captured by the Bolivian army and executed in 1967. Side note, while doing research for this, I learned that among the items recovered after Che's capture was a diary that included poetry, very harsh assessments of his comrades' combat abilities and general intelligence, and a short story about, quote, a young communist guerrilla who learns to overcome his fears, which I would really like to read.
Wow.
On the global stage, the US and USSR, having been shaken by the narrow miss of the missile crisis, replaced the overt hostilities of the 50s with a series of vicious proxy wars fought all over the world between communist and anti-communist forces, backed by their respective ideological superpowers. Although there are communist uprisings pretty much all over the place, the movement's global image is suffering. The construction of the Berlin Wall in 1961 is widely seen as a tacit admission that at the very least, East Germany cannot convince its citizens of the advantages of a communist society and have to erect a physical barrier to keep people from defecting. Not helping is a series of high-profile internal conflicts. Khrushchev is ousted by Leonid Brezhnev in 1964, ending Nikita's mercurial personal style of rule as well as his partial thaw of Soviet society. Of equal note is the 1966 Cultural Revolution in China. Now, there's a lot more to this episode than can be recounted here, but very basically, Mao Zedong, who had stepped away from leadership, comes back into the limelight by accusing Chinese society in general and the CCP specifically of having been infiltrated by counter-revolutionaries, rightists, and capitalists. What follows is a decade-long period of bloody chaos in which people of all societal ranks are purged, which often meant being publicly humiliated, tortured, or executed. The youth-oriented Red Guard kind of runs around the country messing up stuff, and Mao reaffirms his place as the head of Chinese power. Equally problematic for the global revolution is the worsening Sino-Soviet split, an increasingly fractious relationship between the world's most powerful communist states, the USSR and the People's Republic of China, whose divergent implementations of Marxist policies and interpretations of Stalin's legacy led them to compete for the hearts and minds of younger communist states in Eastern Europe and Asia. Unsurprisingly, the USSR has more luck in Europe and China fares better in Asia, although both countries have to throw their weight around as countries in their spheres of influence begin clamoring for liberalization and greater political independence, the response more often than not being violent suppression. The split reaches its nadir in 1969 when a clash over the Russia-China border leads to military conflicts, though neither side declares war. After months of tensions, skirmishes, and belligerent rhetoric, including worsening threats of nuclear launches, the two sides back off from the brink. The West has struggles of its own. France steps back from NATO in 1966 to pursue military independence. Communist uprisings in South and Central America rattle the world's most powerful capitalist nation. And in 1967, Greece suffers a coup that installs a repressive military dictatorship under Georgios Papadopoulos. Nailed that name.
Wow.
Having a dictatorship as a member state of NATO, which fashions itself as an alliance of and defense for democracy and human rights, is actually somewhat embarrassing for the alliance, leading them to take the bold step of doing nothing whatsoever. This intense pressure campaign of inaction has no appreciable effect, and the dictatorship will last until 1975. Now we have to, of course, talk about the Vietnam War. The history of the war in Vietnam actually predates U.S. involvement by decades, and was initially fought by France, but the French bowed out in the mid-50s in America, driven partially by a commitment to halting the spread of communism throughout Asia, and partially by a desire to look cool, intervenes. At the beginning of U.S. involvement, South Vietnam is led by, okay, this is going to be a lot harder than Papadopoulos.
Oh boy.
Ngo Dinh Diem.
All right.
You can tell me if I did that right or wrong. Whose military was flailing despite being better equipped and whose pro-Catholic policies aggravated and disadvantaged the majority Buddhist nation. Diem's autocratic style and intense favoritism towards the Catholic minority led to a CIA-backed coup, what a surprise, against his leadership that ended with his execution in 1963. He was replaced by a series of short-lived military dictators who themselves failed to reverse the country's fortunes and were often targeted by yet more coups. Although limited to military advisors under Kennedy, after the Gulf of Tonkin incident, a misunderstanding that American intelligence deliberately misrepresents to appear like a North Vietnamese provocation, LBJ begins sending in troops for active combat in 1965. This proves to be a military morass from which the U.S. will not extract itself until the preceding decade. In the meantime, American forces are bogged down in a war for which they are utterly unprepared. The guerrilla tactics and constant subterfuge and sabotage of the Viet Cong make the strategies of conventional warfare in which U.S. soldiers have been trained ineffective at best and counterproductive at worst. Bombing runs, napalm, and the infamous defoliating substance, Agent Orange, mainly serve to destroy significant chunks of the Vietnamese jungle and antagonize Vietnamese citizens rather than uproot the VC. Thanks to improvements in television technologies and an army of corporate and independent journalists, the war is thoroughly reported and transmitted back to the American public, which is initially supportive of the war. But a growing anti-war movement, particularly pronounced among students, begins to split public opinion. The countercultural forces dovetail with an increasingly widespread and popular civil rights movement, now represented in the minds of many by Martin Luther King Jr. Although there are many other important figures contributing to the actions, goals, and thought of the fight for racial equality, such as Malcolm X, Ella Baker, and Thurgood Marshall. What is seen by many as the culmination of the movement is the Civil Rights Act of 1964, banning segregation and discrimination in employment, followed by the Voting Rights Act of 1965. This actually preludes decline for the movement, which struggles to expand its activities into the north and west of the U.S., faces severe backlash by racist whites, and in general falls victim to fragmentation and internecine conflict, especially after King is assassinated in 1968. In Africa, finally, stuff I know about Africa. The post-colonial strife for independence reaches its apotheosis in 1960, also known as the Year of Africa, when continental unity became a driving force in African politics. Over a dozen nations achieved sovereignty, sometimes peacefully, sometimes violently, and the global African diaspora was inspired to a new focus on African traditions, histories, and cultures. A thorn in the side of this movement is South Africa, currently under a violent system of minority rule called apartheid. The increasingly visible oppression of the country sparks a worldwide campaign against the racist government, though apartheid would endure for years to come. Finally, some news from the fatherland. In 1964, a coup in Brazil unseats leftist president João Goulart. Not only was the coup financed by the American government, but United States naval and Air Force assets were even positioned to aid the conspirators militarily, although they were ultimately not needed. After the dust settles, the conspirators install a, you guessed it, military dictatorship and will control Brazil for the next 20 years through torture, intimidation, and censorship. As is often the case in these situations, a sudden and forceful transition of government prompts those who, for reasons of political leanings, religious character, or simply unpopular social standings, may be potential targets for the new regime to flee the country as rights and liberties are restricted and state power is vastly expanded. Among those searching for greener pastures are Eduardo Magalhães Jr. and his wife Rebecca, who get the heck out of Dodge barely 2 months after the coup and move to Rebecca's country of origin, the United States, just in time for our father, Eduardo Magalhães III, to be born an American citizen in 1965.
Dang.
Isn't that crazy? The only reason Dad is an American citizen is because of the coup.
I did not know that. That is crazy.
So yeah, that's some of the stuff that was happening in the 60s.
Wow. Well, we always love to have that little historical snippet. Now, maybe a little more relevant is the story of movies in the 60s. And I think both the two big headline things, at least in my mind, in the 60s are the proliferation and success of foreign films. That this was the decade of the French New Wave, which was a hugely innovative new type of filmmaking that came from France, hence the name, as well as a whole bundle of incredibly famous foreign directors such as Akira Kurosawa, Ingmar Bergman, all of the French New Wave directors, Antonio, that's not how to pronounce his name. I can't remember how to pronounce this French guy's name. Federico Fellini. This was just a huge period of innovation and the foreign movie scene really pushing the envelope. At the same time, the American movie scene is having a bad time. There's a fantastic book about this called Pictures at a Revolution, or The Pictures at a Revolution, about the 1967 Best Picture race and how it was emblematic of the declining American classic golden age of Hollywood and the arrival of the new Hollywood that would then carry over into the latter half of the decade and fully carry over into the beginning of the 70s. And this is movies that are typified by much more morally gray characters, much more violent stories that are a little more sexual in nature as the Hays Code finally breaks down and the Motion Picture Association takes over, giving movies, right, a grade for what their content is and who it is appropriate to see those movies. And this kind of signals the end of the golden age of Hollywood as the classic things that have worked up to now, such as musicals and big budget historical epics, all fail in increasingly ridiculous ways. This is when Cleopatra fails. Dr. Doolittle does terribly. This is just the dying gasp of these classic types of Hollywood movies. And I think you'll see both of those things on at least my list. Half of my list is foreign films. Half of my list is, I think I only have like two movies that could be considered, well, maybe three, that could be considered straight. Like, this is a Hollywood picture. A lot of indie filmmaking is starting to get its start, as people are finally able to cheaply get cameras and film in order to make their own movies. We see one of those types of movies on our list. So, yeah, the 60s were a really exciting time to be alive and be doing stuff in movies, as well as all that other stuff going on with, like, the Cold War or whatever. But now that we've spent almost 25 minutes, we can finally get to the subject of this episode. We're going to go through our list of our favorite movies. I think I have 14 on my list. Elliot, I want to say you have close to that as well.
I have 13.
13, great. So we have two lists. We're going to compare the lists, and we're going to whittle this list down to our 10 favorites. Elliot, I think usually how we do this is we go just saying our entire list, and then we're going to talk about the movies we have in common that automatically get onto our top 10 list, the movies that we both love and think are deserving of a spot. And then we're going to go through all the rest of the movies, talk about why they're deserving, why we love them, and, you know, then we're going to start arguing. So, Elliot, why don't you kick this off? Tell the audience, what are the movies that you think people have to see from the 1960s?
All right, I think this is like the fourth iteration of these rules we're going through, but okay.
Good, good.
In no particular order, as usual, my list is Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. Jeez, nice. Louise.
Great.
Harakiri, Night of the Living Dead, Planet of the Apes, A Night in a Planet, Yojimbo, The Battle of Algiers, Judgment at Nuremberg, In the Heat of the Night, Z, or Zed, if you're European, Cool Hand Luke, Django, Cape Fear, and Carnival of Souls.
Nice. All right, my list also in no particular order. Judgment at Nuremberg, Vivre Sa Vie, Night of the Living Dead, La Ventura, The Apartment, Harakiri, Yojimbo, Rosemary's Baby, They Shoot Horses, Don't They? I think it is with a question mark, so I said the question mark. The Virgin Spring, Psycho, Cleo from 5 to 7, Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, and Bonnie and Clyde.
All right, so that makes half of our list,
yeah,
already compiled.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, I do think that might be the most we've had in common.
Yeah. Yeah, and so that's Judgment at Nuremberg, The Night of the Living Dead, Harakiri, Yojimbo, and Dr. Strangelove. Elliot, let's briefly talk. Some of these we've done a review for, but a lot of these we haven't, you know. Let's talk about why we think these are the ones that people need to see, or why we think these are some of the best. You can start with Judgment at Nuremberg.
Yeah, Judgment at Nuremberg. This is a movie. It's hard to describe. It's about the Nuremberg trials, as the name suggests. Specifically, the judges' trials, which was the trial for the judges, the people who were responsible with upholding and enforcing the laws, the racial laws of Nazi Germany. And so it's about, I mean, it's literally about this trial, but more broadly, it's about an already nascent movement within both Germany and the wider world to forget, to wave away, to minimize the crimes and the, not just the crimes of Nazi Germany, but the, excuse me, the society and the outlook that allowed the Nazis to rise to power. Mm-hmm. And it tells all of this through just some of the most emotionally wrought performances and testimonials of the different witnesses and the defendants, and it ends, or it climaxes, with, in my opinion, one of the greatest movie speeches of all time, when
I agree completely.
Yeah, when our main man basically hands down his opinion and says why he's voted the way he's voted, or why it's important, that why this moment is so important. And yeah, Spencer Tracy, isn't that the name of our main guy? He does a fantastic job. Man, this movie's really good, man. This movie's great.
Yeah, it's a powerful, powerful movie. And yeah, for a really long movie, I want to say it's almost 3 hours long, almost entirely comprised of people talking about one of the worst atrocities in human history. It's so compelling, and it's so consistently engaging in a way that I think anyone who watches it is able to, kind of like Schindler's List, that it's a very approachable glimpse into a very complicated and difficult to deal with period of human history. And yeah, I think it's fantastic. I've read reviews of the movie that are kind of dismissive, where they're like, yeah, we get it, the Nazis are bad. And I think that's such a gross understatement of what the movie is trying to, and in my opinion, succeeding to communicate. So it's a fantastic movie. The Night of the Living Dead, we did a review of this movie, so if you want more of our thoughts on it, you can listen to that review. But this is a fantastic movie. This is what I'm talking about, of indie filmmaking is starting to be on the rise. This movie was made for like a nickel and two boots or something like that. Which you wouldn't know watching it. It looks fantastic. It's an incredibly gripping story. It's a really imaginative beginning to the zombie genre. Or other movies could also claim this, but this is the one that probably kicked it off for most people. It's just great. It's also got one of the greatest, most competent horror movie protagonists of all time. I mean, this dude just does everything right.
Yeah. Great. Night of the Living Dead is great. Very layered, very tense. It really, the ornamentation of zombie movies will, of course, evolve and change over the years, from focusing more on the military aspect, focusing more on the civilian aspect, fast zombies, slow zombies, but that core story of a group of survivors trying to navigate not just survival, but also what's worth doing in life. Is survival worth it? How can we survive morally? Does it even matter? That will not change, or at least has not yet changed very much, these 60 years later in the zombie genre.
I'm
always going to have respect for a movie that it's team effort. Great job, team.
Yeah.
But a movie that does basically builds 80% of a genre by itself.
Yeah.
So, yeah. George Romero, I think, great work. Great work, everyone.
What a guy, yeah.
Yeah, what a guy. I don't know if you've ever seen him or seen him talk, but he seems like a really nice guy, and he's also very tall.
Interesting. That's great, Elliot.
It is interesting.
The next one I have on here that we have the same is Harakiri. This, I love this movie. This is such a fantastic movie. If you've never seen this, stop listening to this podcast right now. Go watch Harakiri. And don't read anything else about this movie. I went into this movie blind, and it blew me away. I think it is such a fantastic movie that speaks to, it's about a samurai who comes and wants to...
Why should they not read anything about it if you're just going to tell them about it?
Well, I guess I won't say anything about the plot. But in my opinion, this is one of the most fantastic movies, and this is such a great example of movies speaking to a very specific cultural moment, and because of the universality of human experience, it continues to resonate. I think this is such a beautiful movie about how we use the trappings of good things and we use the legalism of a good set of rules or a good way of operating in the world to then absolve ourselves of having to do actual good to actual human beings. That the characters are hampered by the laws and rules and minutiae of the way they're supposed to act, and so they're unable to see maybe we should do something different to, like, be kind to our fellow man. And I think this is still something that, yeah, this is something I find even in myself, trying to avoid just doing things to look good and genuinely trying to do good, and what a huge difference there is between the appearance of something good and something that actually does good. I think it's so fantastic, so well written, so many great performances, one of the best. It's a great samurai movie, probably the best samurai movie in my opinion. It's so fantastic. I love this movie.
I agree, and I won't say anything to preserve the experience for you, but yeah, this is among the most intelligent movies that I can think of, certainly that I can think of off the top of my head. And yeah, I think that the movie's area of inquiry remains fascinating to me. And I actually recommended Harakiri for The Green Knight, which does tell you a little bit about what kind of movie it is, because I think that they are basically about something very similar. And I'm not going to add to what Nathan said. I think that that was a perfect summary of the themes of Harakiri. But yeah, definitely not just one of the best movies of the 60s, in my opinion, my humble opinion. And I know that this is a really hot take. Not a lot of people out there saying this. But this is among the best movies of all time.
Yeah, that absolutely agree. Then we got Yojimbo. This Akira Kurosawa finally appearing on one of our lists. I think I've been fighting for his appearance a couple of times now. It's fantastic, okay? This man was on the craziest of runs during this period in the 50s to 60s. And Yojimbo's just fantastic. I mean, we got all the classic Kurosawa actors, and it's just so cool. It's so funny. It's so well made. I love the way Kurosawa shoots his movies, and there's so many great shots in here, and it's just a fun, engaging story. So much so, Sergio Leone stole it a couple years later to make Fistful of Dollars, I think, right? Fistful of Dollars. And yes. Even that version is still really good, but it's not as good as the original.
I agree. I mean, Fistful of Dollars isn't even on this list, so there it is. But yeah, I like Westerns, and I like samurai movies, probably because Westerns are just samurai movies.
Yeah.
The root of the Western is firmly planted in samurai movies, samurai cinema. And Yojimbo is some of the best that the genre has to offer. Toshihiro Mifune, he's a great actor. I love watching him. And yeah, I think that you nailed it. This is a cool movie. This is one of those movies that's just cool from head to toe. And I can absolutely understand why such a simple but infinitely malleable premise would move people to borrow it so many times.
Yeah. And then the last movie we have on here, Dr. Strangelove. Yet again, a director that I think I've been trying to get on here for a couple of decades. Stanley Kubrick. I guess the biggest thing for me that makes me enjoy this movie, it is very interesting. It's about the Cold War, which, as we talked about, was on people's minds. It continues to be interesting. But for me, this movie is just so funny. The president having to comfort the, like, Russian premier, where he's like, yeah, I'm really upset about it. No, I'm sure that you're more upset. No, we're both upset about the way this is. That's so funny. I love, what's the name of the actor? The guy who plays the general.
I don't know.
It's not coming to me. I love when he's describing the plane at the end where they're like, can it make it? Can it make it? Oh, hell yeah, it can make it, Mr. President. That's the best we have. It's so funny. Peter Sellers in four different roles or three different roles or whatever is so great. And yeah, just a ridiculous farce of a story, but it's so funny. And I think it continues to work because the people... We continue to not have a huge amount of faith in our institutions and the people in our institutions. So I think Dr. Strangelove continues to resonate because we're like, yeah, that could happen. I don't know. They don't seem like they've got it as much together as I'd like.
The attitudes certainly have not changed.
Yeah.
Now, I have nothing to add. Dr. Strangelove is a great movie. And... it's one of the earliest appearances of James Earl Jones. Yes. So that's neat.
Yeah. Also, one of the most parodied shot. It shows up all the time.
Yep.
Anyway, so we have five. We need five more, Elliot.
Mm-hmm.
So now I think this is usually when we talk about all of the movies we've picked. We're going to trade off. You can go first. You know, why'd you pick it? Why should it make it in one of these last five spots?
Well, I think that we should both start by talking about there's a movie on both of our lists that the other has not watched. And so that's going to be automatically disqualified.
Yeah.
And I think we should start talking about that.
Yeah.
Start talking about that.
Yeah. So for me, I think you didn't get around to They Shoot Horses, Don't They?
It's not that I didn't get around to it. It's that it's very difficult to find.
Well, that's too bad. But like a diamond in the rough, it is worth the effort to find it, I would say. This is a great movie. It was one of my favorite movies from whatever year it was I first saw it. It is just an incredible, a bizarrely gripping story, despite the it's not incredibly high stakes, but the movie does such an amazing job of sucking you into its tale. It's about dance marathons in the Great Depression, where people would have to dance for days and days on end as they start to just experience all of the physical effects of staying awake and active for that many days. The movie is just brutal. It's a brutal, brutal time. There's so many scenes that had me on the edge of my seat, of just the simplest things of people trying to stay on their feet. And it's got an incredible ending. The title of I love the title of this movie because it's so poignant and great, and its use in the film is fantastic. And yeah, it's too bad you didn't see it. Also, one of the most nominated movies of all time at the Oscars to then come away with no wins. I believe it was nominated for like seven different things and it didn't win anything. So one of history's great losers in that sense.
Well, that's pretty impressive. We've got to, our next ranking episode is actually going to be our last, and got to have all of our movies we've got to watch all of the movies.
Well, one of these times.
Nathan doesn't like to do quick Google searches to make sure that all of his movies are actually available to watch. Because that's such a huge time sink.
I don't see why I should leave a movie off my list just because it's difficult to watch. It's one of the best movies of the 60s.
But okay, we're anyway. Not going to talk about this. We're going to talk about this at our meeting later tonight. For me, my movie is actually very easy to find, but in fairness, it's a late edition, so Nathan didn't have a lot of time to watch it. But that's going to be the original Cape Fear. So this is about a lawyer who puts away a bad man, a criminal, who then 8 years later is released from prison and vows to destroy this lawyer's life. And Scorsese remade it, I think, in the 90s or sometime later. But in this original, first of all, I think this is a great thriller. right? Mm. Like, there's a lot of maneuvering, a lot of really tense standoffs. Nobody can... Everyone's trying to... Well, obviously the criminal's not trying to operate within the law, but the lawyer, played by Gregory Peck, who, by the way, Gregory Peck, I mean, dang, that's just a cool man, right? He just commands the screen.
Yeah.
He is trying to work within the law, and the difficulties of doing that create, I think, a very interesting portrait. And I do think that this is intentional, that the movie is trying to explore the place of law, the purpose of law in a lawless time, right? This came out, I think, a year or so after the Cuban Missile Crisis, like the closest the world has come to deliberate nuclear war. People are losing faith in the American experiment, even more than they are now. there's a sense that these institutions, the institutions of modern life, are failing to serve their purpose, and they're not protecting people. And yet, right, they can only, you can't, the idea on the movie's mind, I guess, is that you can't make a law that only protects people who are worth protecting, quote unquote. That there's this gap between what a democracy is capable of doing in security-wise and what people want it to do. And beyond this threshold, this outer threshold, you're getting into some morally and politically questionable territory. So I think the movie is really interesting. If I had watched it before we did our review for this, I would have recommended it for Prisoners, which should tell you the kind of movie that this is. So I think you would like it, Nathan. I still think you should watch it if you ever get the chance.
Well, I'll do my best, Elliot. My next movie on the list, we gotta show some representation to the French New Wave, Vivre Sa Vie. This is another movie that I loved. I've talked about it on the podcast before, and I guess it's the only movie from the French New Wave that I've ever watched that gave me the same feeling that I think it gave people at the time. That the French New Wave was exciting because you were seeing movies made in a way you had never seen before. And so many of the other French New Waves that I've seen are just too, maybe too influential, or too, their style is too, has seeped into too much of the film landscape. And so it's impossible for me to watch Breathless with the same level of excitement as someone would in the day and age when it came out, because there's so many other movies that look like Breathless, and there's so many other movies that are about more interesting characters than what Breathless is about. Not to knock Breathless, but I don't think it's that great. But Vivre Sa Vie does give me that feeling. Every section, the movie is kind of split up into a bunch of different pieces, all following the story of a woman as she slowly kind of descends into her life is kind of falling apart. But every scene is filmed in such a creative and amazing way. And there's one shot in particular in this movie. There's a pan that's timed to a machine gun going off. That's just crazy. That's a crazy filmmaking thing. And it might sound like that's whatever, but it's so neat to watch a movie that has things you've never seen in, or things you've never even thought of. Like, yeah, you don't have to pan smoothly. You could pan to the rhythm of something. And it's just a great, not to be too pretentious here, but great, like, musical, lyrical filmmaking that makes every moment of the film's admittedly kind of threadbare story so enjoyable for me to watch. It's just so great.
All right. My next movie is going to be the original Planet of the Apes. We are Planet of the Apes fans here at Magellan's at the Movies, at least of the reboot from the 21st century.
Yeah.
And this is the only other Planet of the Apes movie that I've seen, but I really enjoy it. This is such a great thinking man's adventure, very much like Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. If you didn't know, this movie was written by Rod Serling, the creator and writer of Twilight Zone, and that makes perfect sense because this is basically a Twilight Zone episode writ large.
Yeah.
It's got the weird sort of science fiction premise that people have to deduce and understand. It's got the twist ending. You can practically hear Rod Serling saying something over the final pan out of the twist, where he's like, "Oh, they don't have liberty here." In the Twilight Zone, he would probably say something better than that. But even aside from the movie's interesting premise and the great acting and the prosthetic costumes for the ape characters, I think that the movie manages to wring so much entertainment out of what should be a dry story about the legalese of ape society and the relationship between the ape religion and the ape science. I know it sounds so silly, but it's one of those movies that manages to transcend its premise and become something interesting and engaging and entertaining and thought-provoking in the end, at least in my opinion. So yeah, there you go.
My next movie, La Ventura. This is just a great movie where nothing happens and no one does anything. It's ostensibly about a missing persons case. Some friends go out on a boating cruise and one of their numbers goes missing. And then it's a fairly famous, rich sort of person. And so there's a bit of media fanfare and the people are talking about things. But it's just such a great movie about people completely unmotivated to do anything. And I'm increasingly drawn to movies about people that are kind of just faffing about their time. They're not doing anything meaningful. They're sleepwalking through their life. And I think this movie is one of the most evocative depictions of that sort of thing, as you're practically screaming at the movie, please do anything, like make any effort to do anything in your life, as these people just continue to waste away all of their time, even when faced with something inexplicable and something as horrifying as a friend of yours going missing and being presumed dead. I think it's so great. It's a movie that I really had meant to rewatch before we did this, but it's just stuck in my mind so much since I've watched it, and I think it is because of this potent depiction of a meaningful, unreflective life.
Blah, blah, blah. my next movie is going to be The Battle of Algiers, and it's fascinating how a movie made at a time of limited special effects, when the special effects that you do have available to you are somewhat limited, even in France, which is takes a bit more of a libertine approach to movies than America does, certainly a less censorious position. But even that society has boundaries, and yet to make a movie about or a military action that is, in my opinion, every bit as gritty and authentic as something like Saving Private Ryan, that's an accomplishment for the ages. If you didn't know, this movie is based on a real story. I looked up the real story and now I've kind of forgotten a lot of the details. But it takes place in French-controlled Algiers during a time when Algeria is agitating for independence from French rule. And so, of course, a violent insurgency has been formed. And it's basically about these two opposing groups doing increasingly terrible things to themselves and each other.
Yeah.
It is looking right into the complexities and the the ugliness of war, especially an urban guerrilla war like what's happening in Algiers here at this time. This is a hard movie to find anyone to root for in. But yeah, it's really interesting and still, and I mean, entertaining is probably the wrong word, but still compelling.
Yeah.
Right. It is a gripping watch. That's in due in large part to some very energetic editing, some fantastic performances. The French colonel in the sunglasses. He's a character that stuck with me even these years since I first watched it. So yeah, I think that, I mean, heck, it's on my list. I think it's one of the best movies of the 60s. Yeah. I didn't put it there on accident.
Yeah. My next one, Billy Wilder's The Apartment. Look, Billy Wilder is probably one of the greatest directors of all time. And if we kept doing this decade by decade, the 50s would be, there would be a meaningful percentage of Billy Wilder movies on my list. I think he is just one of the greatest writers to ever screenwrite for the films. He's one of the greatest directors. He had such a great sense of amazing stories that are interesting and compelling. I see The Apartment as kind of the last greatest epitome of golden age Hollywood filmmaking. And it's amazing. It follows Jack Lemmon, who is portraying a pencil pusher at an accounting firm who loans out his apartment for the higher ups at his company to meet their mistresses at. And eventually he ends up having some moral qualms about this. And every time I show this movie to people, it's tough for them to get into it. It's kind of a weird premise, and they think it's kind of a gross premise. This is what I always tell people, that I think it's fascinating that a guy who fled from Nazi Germany made a movie basically saying, if you are okay with being a cog in the wheel of something that's harming people, it is your job to remove yourself from that situation and cease being a cog. I think it's so interesting who The Apartment chooses to focus on, and I think it's so well done as this character deals with the moral ramifications of what they're doing and what they've already done. It's a super funny movie. It's so witty. I love saying that's how it crumbles cookie-wise. What a great line. Holy cow. Amazingly well acted by everyone. It's just such a great, great movie. I love this. It's great. One of the best movies of the 60s.
All right, man, we got to pick this up here. My next movie is In the Heat of the Night. This movie is, oh my gosh, this movie is tailor-made for me. I wouldn't be surprised if somebody, one of the writers or the director, looked into the future and saw me and was like, I'm going to make a movie for this person. Because it's a procedural, a detective procedural, and it's about two people overcoming their differences and becoming friends. That is my movie right there. If you didn't know, this is a Sidney Poitier movie where he plays a detective who is in a who sort of lays over in a town and becomes tangled up in a mystery while also trying to navigate the deeply embedded racism of this town and the deeply embedded racism of the sheriff with whom he becomes friends. It's like, come on, man. Yeah, I just love movies where people overcome their differences and become friends. It sounds so cheesy, and it is cheesy, but it's a formula that really works for me. And I mean, do you need me to tell you that Sidney Poitier is a good actor and turns in a good performance? Exactly. And the procedural, like, it's a good procedural. It's a good mystery. I enjoy peeling back the layers and being right there alongside the characters as they make their discoveries and get to the heart of it. And the ending, the last exchange between the two characters, just makes me smile. It still makes me smile when I think about it. So yeah, that's my next pick.
My next pick is Rosemary's Baby. Roman Polanski, scumbag, made a fantastic movie. Okay, Rosemary's Baby, I think it's a movie that's aged phenomenally. All of its discussion of a woman trying to call attention to her own plight. In this case, Rosemary believes that she's part of a plot of Satanists to try and bring about the spawn of Satan. And she struggles to convince anyone of the reality of this. She's constantly gaslit from other characters and other people. There's a great sequence near the end of the movie where I was like, wow, this is great. And then something happens and I was like, oh, fiddlesticks. Dang it. So well done. Amazing performance. And yeah, it's just a great psychological thriller and has so many great different pieces. And it's also, it's frustrating to me sometimes how many of these modern thrillers are like, it's elevated horror because it's about like trauma, and then they're all about trauma. I'm like, dude, make elevated horror about something else, like women's problems, convincing other people and doctors like, hey, I'm in pain and I need you to help me. I think it's fantastic, fantastically well-made movie. Maybe Polanski should have like watched his movie a couple of times and taken a lesson from it or something. I don't know, but it's a great movie.
All right. My next movie is Zed. I'm just going to call it Z. Come on. Great. This is a movie that is based on, it's a very thinly fictionalized account of a real Greek judge. Was it a judge?
Yeah, something like that.
Someone popular, a popular leftist or liberal who was assassinated in Greece a few years before that military junta that I talked about in the historical context rose to power. And what are you laughing about, Nathan?
That's why we had to have it, so you understood Z.
Exactly. It's hard to describe this movie. I was not immediately in on this movie, but there came a point where the person who's assassinated, his wife, is invited to a sort of debriefing by the doctors. And there are just these little flashes, just like barely there edits of her memories of like, hanging out with her husband, driving through town, just being together. And I was like, okay, yeah, no. This movie understands grief and how people react in these situations. And I said to Nathan that the movie is almost academic in the way that it just patiently sets out facts for you as people try to deduce who's at the heart of this conspiracy, because it is a conspiracy and it wasn't real life, to kill this popular opposition leader. So yeah, it's both very intelligent in the way that it's constructed and in the way that it sets out for you and keeps you engaged in the mystery, but also very compelling in that it doesn't lose sight of the heart of, this is a story about people who murdered someone for his political beliefs and then jury-rigged the system so that they could get away with it. And the system didn't require that much rigging, right? It was pretty easy to rig. So yeah, I think that if you have not seen this movie, I mean, obviously, I think you should watch it. It's on the list. But I think especially, this would be, I think, a great movie to start with for somebody who wants to get into foreign films.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. In service of trying to move this along, I have Psycho on my list. We did a review of Psycho. I don't have to talk super long about it. It's fantastic. Alfred Hitchcock just absolutely killing it here. Amazing, amazing movie. I also have The Virgin Spring. This is another movie that I loved. I talked about on the podcast previously, and I just think it's an incredible, I think every time I describe it, I talk of it like it's a mythic story. It feels like a fable that you would tell that has so many different little morals inside of it as you dive into the different layers of characters and what they're doing and their how they're interacting with each other. And I just think the ending is fantastic. It really just hits me in the gut. It really connects with me. It's a great movie. Great Ingmar Bergman movie.
My next movie is Cool Hand Luke. This is a movie very much in the vein of, excuse me, The Shawshank Redemption or One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, in that it's about an outsider who is thrown into prison or, right, an institution and refuses to conform. And in so doing, sort of leads his fellow prisoners or inmates or whatever to look at themselves differently and look at their situation differently because, right, this, excuse me, gosh dang. The prison is run by an autocratic warden, but Luke himself, he is your nonconformist's nonconformist. And so it reminds me a lot of the way One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, the novel, plays out, in that Luke is always sort of engaging in these little acts of rebellion against the prison's leadership and showing that the mindset of freedom in these situations can be just as important as the instruments of freedom. Plus, it's got, I've literally just forgotten his name, Paul Newman.
Yeah.
Giving a great performance as Luke. This is such a classic, I think, protagonist, leading man protagonist from this era. Yeah. That he's not aggressive, but he's very composed and he's absolutely willing to defend himself when it comes down to it. But in general, he's just unflappable, I think is how I would describe him. And yeah, it's great.
Yeah. Switching to a completely flappable protagonist, I've got Agnes Varda's Cleo from 5 to 7. This is my second French New Wave. This is much less of the French New Wave style, but still some of that same ethos of it's kind of just about a woman. I mean, from the title, it's about Cleo from 5 to 7. Cleo is waiting for news on a recent medical test that she believes might say whether or not she has a debilitating illness that's going to kill her. And it's just 2 hours of her ruminating on her life in light of its possible impending end that she has to reevaluate. She's a singer and she doesn't like the music she likes. She's hanging out with her boyfriend. She's going and doing the things that she normally does, and she can't do it the same because of this knowledge, because of this thing that she's forced to wrestle with. And I think it's so fantastic. I don't know if there's ever been a protagonist that I more felt close to so quickly. And I think it's such a well-made movie. It's such a great, enjoyable time. And it's got so many cute little moments scattered throughout. But I just think it's such a fascinating, interesting movie about this character.
My next movie is going to be Django, the original Django, to which Django Unchained is a bit of an homage. This movie is just a over-the-top blast. It's got a machine gun that is definitely not being used properly. It's got a taciturn, stubbly leading man who can kill people in, like, I don't know. People just don't. He's too fast. He's too fast on the draw. He can kill 6 men in a single discharge of his his revolver. I don't really have anything intelligent to say about this movie because this movie's not intelligent. It's just fun. It's just about this huge, surprisingly sprawling adventure as this guy tries to get gold and maybe get a little revenge along the way and learn a lesson if he wants to. I don't know. And the main character's like theme song is just about all the many losses he's had in life. That's hilarious. I loved this movie. Maybe a little bit more than it deserved, but I thought it was great.
My last movie is Bonnie and Clyde. This is, again, the French New Wave was hugely influential. The foreign movies were hugely influential. And Bonnie and Clyde is that ethos, that type of filmmaking finally making its way to America. And it's amazing. It's so fun to see this exciting new type of story being told. And Bonnie and Clyde are the perfect foil. I mean, this is classic Americana. If you love Lana Del Rey songs, you would probably love Bonnie and Clyde, because there's just something so romantic about two people setting off to stick it to the man through robbing banks or whatever. It's so well made. It's so fun. We rob banks is such a great line delivered so well. And yeah, the ending is just fantastic. It's crazy.
Okay, my last movie is going to be Carnival of Souls. This is another indie movie, probably made for even less than the boot and 2 cents that Night of the Living Dead was made for. And this movie was such a shock to me because it is definitely cheap and the sound quality is terrible. It sounds like for the microphone, they got like, I don't know, just a dude giving it his best shot of trying to recreate their the performances of the characters on screen. But it manages to do a lot with very little in terms of its horror about this woman being who survives a car crash and is then stalked by a strange man appearing in these visions. And more than that, I was surprised at how adeptly it was able to portray the way in which, and I know, Nathan, when you said that elevator horror is all about trauma, I was like, I wonder what Nathan thought about this movie, because it is definitely about trauma. But in the movie's defense, it got there first, or got there earlier. Yeah. And also, I think that it is unique in that it displays, and in my opinion, accurately portrays the alienating effect that enduring this kind of trauma can produce, that the main character finds that she's no longer to relate to herself or the world around her in the aftermath of this terrible mental and physical shock. So I thought that the movie was just I was stunned at how sensitive and intelligent the movie was. And yeah, I was not expecting it to be on this list, but here it is.
Wow. That's neat. This is the worst part of the episode, Elliot. Maybe not for you, but for me, because I feel bad at all times. This is the veto section, right? Some of these movies don't have a prayer of getting on. So this is where we veto. Elliot, you can go first. I already know you have a bunch of vetoes locked and loaded. You've been desperately waiting to say how bad my movies are. So what are the movies you're going to veto here?
So do we do all of these at once?
Yeah, you could just do all of them at once.
I just rip off the Band-Aid? Okay. Yeah. So I'm going to veto Vivre sa Vie.
Oh.
I don't know what to tell you. This movie is a boring, big pot of nothing. It flabbergasts me how people can be like, oh, the story doesn't exist and the main character is flatter than paper. But, right, there's a goofy camera trick in it. So the movie's great. Wow. I do not personally hold with that. I think that the machine gun pan is a machine gun pan. Great job, guys. But that takes like 2 seconds in a movie that's over an hour long. So we are going to need to do a little bit more than that. Maybe invest just a little bit more time into the characters and the plot. And if you could also take more than 30 seconds to figure out your extremely lame shock, oh my gosh, what's happening to the character ending, that would also be great, Mr. Godard. I'm also going to veto La Ventura.
Oh, I mean, that makes sense.
What? I don't even know what to say about this movie. It must be just the sweetest gig of all time to be cast in one of these movies. Like, can you imagine what the casting call is like? It's like looking for a young woman with with supermodel quality looks must be able to stare blankly into the middle distance and do a frowny face occasionally. And that's it.
Gosh. It's amazing.
Like, powerful. I could kill in one of these movies. What?
It's powerful filmmaking.
It is true. No, it's not. I could do so well in one of these movies. I could stare blankly into the middle distance. That's basically what I do all day. If anyone's out there and wants me in a movie like La Ventura, give me a call. I'll do it.
Great.
I'm also going to veto The Virgin Spring.
Oh.
This is another example, and I feel like this happens a lot in movies like this, where there's like 15 minutes of an actually interesting, compelling movie, but the movie insists on its commitment to telling it like it is, or realism, or I don't even know what its commitment exactly is to, but whatever it is, it always entails heaps upon heaps upon heaps of setup that we don't need. And so it means that the payoff is so brief and so unsatisfying, because most of the setup is actually just shots of people talking about nothing or riding through some admittedly beautiful landscape. I guess that's the Swiss landscape.
Yeah.
Not the worst thing I've ever seen, but definitely not my favorite thing I've ever seen. And finally, I am going to veto Rosemary's Baby. I gotta say, screw you, Roman Polanski, you slime ball. And also, again, this movie isn't terrible, but it's not very scary at all. And I have to say, as far as antagonists go, an affable book club of geriatrics who happen to be Satanists, I can think of some more intimidating antagonists, right? I kept on thinking, well, surely there's going to be a turn here, right? And all of these friendly old people will do something, will be a little bit creepier, or they'll say something strange and unsettling. But no, they're all acting like your lovable grandparents. And maybe for some people that creates a really frightening contrast. Maybe that has the same effect as the people going about their daily lives in the zone of interest. It doesn't work for me here. So yeah, again, it's not something that I hated, but definitely not the kind of movie, not nearly good enough to reach the top 10 of the 60s. And I have to veto Clear from 5 to 7.
Let me just say, you just vetoed all of the foreign films. That's crazy. The Americanism is insane.
Well, as soon as the foreign people start making better movies, they can be on the list.
Wow.
But I already have foreign movies on my list, and there's already a foreign movie, more than one foreign movie, on the list, isn't there?
Yeah, thank goodness. Thank goodness they made it past your treacherous hands.
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah, that's fine. I figured you wouldn't like those. You know, they're just too smart for you. Anyway, I'm going to veto here. I'm going to be a bit nicer than you. I'm vetoing Django. I just don't think I had as much fun with it as you did, because I think I was much more on the side of, wow, this is kind of stupid, isn't it? And less like, well, this is sick. I do think, the movie gets a lot of points for having a theme song about the main character where they say, Django, he's so alone. That's crazy.
That is not how you're supposed to operate a machine gun, right? You can't just pick it up and carry it around.
Checks out to me. I'm also going to have to veto In the Heat of the Night. This is a movie that's maybe perfect for you, not perfect for me. I kind of agree with criticisms that it's half of two good movies smushed together into one sort of mediocre movie that I think the procedural aspect is hampered by the racism aspect, is hampered by the procedural aspect, is hampered by the racism aspect, that I don't feel like they work together as well as they do separately. And so there's good scenes, but then they don't really lead into another good scene, into a different thing. And lastly, I'm going to veto Planet of the Apes. I like this movie. I do agree with a lot of the stuff you're saying, but I do think it is overly long. And I think some of the things it's trying to say, maybe about the relationship between science and religion, I don't find it incredibly compelling or interesting the way that it's looking at these two things. And so it just ends up being a kind of novel movie that's well made. It's got, you know, neat costumes and all that sort of stuff, but I don't find the other aspects of it intriguing enough to keep me coming back.
Well, damn you all to hell, Nathan.
whoa,
I'm just kidding,
it's a kids podcast.
Sorry, that's a joke. All right, so what we do now, we have 7 movies for 5 slots. That's pretty tight, actually. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a little break. We're going to rank these last movies based on how much we want to see them on the list. And then we'll reconvene and sort of compare notes and try to get the latter half of the list up and ready.
All right, we're back. We have a ranking. Elliot, let me know, what is your number one movie remaining on our list?
Number one is Z.
All right, I got Z at 4th.
Oh, interesting.
I like Z. I agree with a lot of the stuff you said. I think you have another movie that's similar to Z that I would probably put above it that I enjoy a little bit more. But yeah, it's really good. I think it should stick around because I think it has 4th, obviously. We have 5 spots. It has a fighting chance to make it into those 5 spots.
All right, Z goes on a maybe list. Nathan, what's your number one?
My number one is The Apartment.
What a surprise. that's number 3 for me, so yes. I think that it can pretty comfortably make it onto the list.
Let's go. You say what you say.
I don't like Billy Wilder, or at least I've never liked a Billy Wilder movie to the extent that Nathan has, but this is definitely my favorite of his, and I don't know. It's absolutely a compelling and entertaining watch, and it's the one movie where I do feel like the script is really fiery. Not fiery, that's probably the wrong word, but the script crackles with that wit and that energy that other people ascribe to Billy Wilder movies that I unfortunately have not seen in the other stuff of his that I've seen. But definitely a very good movie and one that's worthy of Jones at the Movies, Best of the 60s. So let's put that on there.
Nice. Yes.
My turn, right?
Yep.
Number 2, I've got Battle of Algiers.
That's my number 2.
Oh, perfect. On it goes.
Yeah, like I said, there's a better version of Z on this list. It's the Battle of Algiers. That French colonel, fantastic. This is a crazy, like, even-handed and morally gray movie for a movie that was genuinely supported by the French government. Like, the French government helped finance this film, and the French government doesn't come out of this movie looking great, but it's such a great movie, like you said, super gritty and realistic despite, like, being filmed so goofily, kind of.
Okay, then.
Yeah, it's a great movie. I think that takes it back to you, because that was my number 2.
Oh, all right. Well, my number 3 is The Apartment. So, number 4 is Psycho.
I got Psycho at number 5.
Interesting. Well, I definitely enjoy Psycho. I think I did not give it as strong a review as you did when we did review it.
Yep.
Undeniably an enjoyable movie. I mean, I'm hedging here. More than enjoyable. Very good movie. My issue, as least as I remember it, was that it was kind of that the main character, right, doesn't exist for a while. Yeah. And I think we saw in Alien a really good way to handle a main character shift. Mm-hmm. That I don't quite see the same in Psycho. So, I mean, but they're very close. So let's put it to the side for right now and hear your number three, and then we'll revisit that.
My number three is Bonnie and Clyde.
Oh, that's my number six.
Oh, no.
I don't dislike Bonnie and Clyde. Hmm. I do think it's good. I think it's very good. I just think that it's just very good.
Yeah.
Which seems weird to say, but right, we're talking about the best of the best.
Okay. Well, I'd say let's put Z and Psycho on, because those had them in our top five.
That's literally what I was going to suggest.
Amazing.
Oh boy, that leaves us with one last spot.
Yeah, and I guess the other two movies we haven't talked about yet, Cool Hand Luke. I like Cool Hand Luke. I think I have it at six for me. I think it's one of those movies where probably if I saw it before I saw The Shawshank Redemption and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, I would really, really love it. But because I saw those first, watching this one is kind of a weird feeling of I've seen this movie done a little bit better. And yeah, Paul Newman is fantastic. It's a classic Paul Newman role, but I don't love it. And then Carnival of Souls, yeah, I like you said, I'm kind of over horror as a mechanism to investigate trauma. And I do think this movie is better than like Midsommar in that regard, because it has a more interesting thing to say about it. I very much agree with your assessment that it's also about just how alone it feels and how alienating you can feel not feeling similar to other people. And I think it is very effective in that sense, but I'm not like over the moon about it. I didn't love it. So yeah, these are the three left. We gotta pick one.
Well, usually, or what Nathan always insists that we do, is we do the one that's the closest to each other, right? So my number five is Carnival of Souls. That's your, what, number seven?
Yep.
What's your number five?
Number five is Psycho.
What's your number five? What's number six?
Cool Hand Luke.
Oh, so these bottom three are the bottom three. So what's closest here? Gosh dang it.
I think it's probably Cool Hand Luke, right? What was Cool Hand Luke at for you?
It was actually at seven.
It was at seven? Well, then it's definitely the closest, because it's a difference of one. Well, because it seems like we really feel differently about Bonnie and Clyde in terms of where that should fall.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's Cool Hand Luke.
Okay. I'm fine with Cool Hand Luke getting on it. Like I said, I think it's very deserving. It's a very good movie. Great Paul Newman role. Although I would say, personally, I would go maybe more The Great Escape. That might be a 50s movie, though. So that's, neither here nor there. But yeah, Cool Hand Luke. What we have here is a failure to communicate.
Oh, there it is. The line. No, The Great Escape is 1963.
Dang. Should have put that on there.
Well, I didn't watch The Great Escape, so.
Oh, that's too bad. You.
All right, that's. All right, shush. Cool Hand Luke is on there. So, the Magellans at the Movies official best films of the 1960s, in no particular order, are as follows: Judgment at Nuremberg, Night of the Living Dead, Yojimbo, Doctor Strangelove, Harakiri, I don't know why I'm doing this, The Apartment, The Battle of Algiers, Z, Psycho, and Cool Hand Luke.
Dang.
That's everyone applauding.
Nice.
Well, yeah. I'm pretty satisfied with that list.
I'm happy with that list.
I think that's a list that we can
too.
Be proud of.
Yeah, I agree. So yeah, thank you so much for listening. Elliot, do you want to do your outro before I get into my outro?
Life is hard and full of disappointments, right?
Yeah, that's sort of true. But thank you so much for listening. This is a bit of a jumbo episode. If there's a movie that you are shocked we didn't have, you know, send us an email. We love to have questions. Send us an email.
We probably didn't watch it.
Well, maybe. Or if it's something like 2001 A Space Odyssey, we just feel differently about it than other people do. But we're going to be back next week. We're going to be doing another super fun movie review. So look forward for that. And we hope you have a great week in between.